suggest glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be
every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
In Berkeley, California, at the Mothership, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavila Molina and Francisco Herrera. Today on the show, starvation on the rise as the brutality, the brutal military continues to shred children in Gaza. Rhea Giroir of Democracy for the Arab World Now provides an update on the Gaza genocide and some background on the implications of Trump's recent visit, he's just leaving now, to the Middle East. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned.
I hunger now.
For the children, that's Francisco Herrera. My name is Dennis Bernstein, here with Miguel Gavila Molina. This is the Flashpoint show on Pacifica Radio, and we turn our attention back to the expanding genocide, which seems like a plan that includes a slow mass starvation. I'm not sure how else to describe this, Rao Girard. Joining us is Rao Girard, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now. By the way, that's a group founded by slain Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Rao, welcome back to Flashpoint. So we appreciate that you could join us today. These are terrible times, and, you know, there's no doubt that we see two of the most heavily armed countries in the world using the most advanced weaponry to shred kids in diapers along with their mothers and whole families. This continues apace, doesn't it?
Getting worse and worse, Dennis. I know I've been coming to your show in the past 19 months to speak about the genocide, and it is getting worse and worse. This week has been one of the worst, if not the worst week of killings since the beginning of the genocide. There were hundreds of Palestinian civilians killed every day. Destruction of entire neighborhoods in northern Gaza. And the starvation is no longer a slow starvation. It is an open campaign to use food as a weapon of war. Palestinians are literally being starved to death as we speak. This is all happening under the support and funding of the United States.
You know, this is incredibly troubling, and I don't have to tell you, somebody who sort of was forced out of your homeland of Iraq, somebody who watched what the United States government is capable of. I keep hearing the echo of the former Secretary of State when all the thousands of children were dying as a result of U.S. policy. She didn't care very much. This seems like that policy on steroids.
That's true. And I mean, you're right. I'm half Iraqi and half Palestinian. And I have to say, both my Iraqi and Palestinian families have seen these brutal policies coming from Israel and the United States for decades. 77 years ago, my Palestinian family was one of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians displaced when Nakba happened on May 15th. Many Palestinians have been saying that Nakba has been going on since May 15th. It's not a singular event. This week's events are a continuation of the Nakba that started on May 15th, 1948. My paternal grandpa and grandma were in Haifa at that time, and they were displaced back to their hometown of Jenin because of the Nakba. And at a later point, they were pushed out of the country. But you're right. I mean, you look at these U.S. policies and Israeli policies, these are not accidental. Policies of starvation in Palestine have gone on for almost 100 years now, even from the time of the British Mandate in Palestine. I remember my grandfather telling me about starvation and the use of food as a weapon of war, even under the British Mandate against the Palestinian people. These are not new tactics. You know, being brutal, having these genocidal regimes, these are not new. But what's new is that we are watching it live streamed on our phones,
and it really feels, I don't say this easily, it really feels Nazi-like, the way in which they have devised a plan of a slow starving by literally counting the calories. They know how they've decided in their way, they've got a process and a method of mass murdering Palestinian people.
Yeah, I mean, that was before. That was during the blockade. Now there is zero calories going in. They are cutting all any incoming humanitarian aid and food to Gaza. It's been more than 2 months at this point. Complete and total blockade, which is a war crime. It's a crime against humanity. It is one of the main charges of genocide by the ICC against Israeli leaders. It is one of the main charges mentioned with the ICJ against Israel in the case that was submitted by South Africa. And we can see it now happening on a daily basis. Well, of course, President Trump, he said a few deceiving things on his way to the Middle East, and he tried to claim that he's going to change the policy, he's going to end the U.S. support of genocide. He did a couple of big moves on the way when he announced a unilateral ceasefire with Yemen, when he announced that he's going to lift the sanctions on Syria. These were indeed policies that were not approved or supported by Israel. But he did deceive the Palestinians into releasing the one and only U.S. Israeli citizen who's a soldier who was held by Palestinians as a prisoner of war. He deceived them into releasing that prisoner with very clear promises that in return Trump himself will push for humanitarian aid to enter Gaza and to end the starvation within 2 days of that. The release happened more than 2 days, and we haven't really seen any results to date. Instead of the Trump administration stepping in to end the genocide, today we just heard a news break just right before I came on the show about a new insane plan that is being discussed by the Trump administration to move 1 million Palestinians out of Gaza to Libya, to the country of Libya in northern Africa. Wow. This is obviously like a genocidal plan, moving people out of their home country permanently. Is a crime against humanity. It's happening within one of the most brutal genocides we have witnessed in the past decades. And for Trump to be a part of this makes him a partner in crime. So last week he was trying to portray himself as the savior who's going to show up on his white horse and save the day and stop the genocide. I think everyone is coming to a conclusion now that he's actually what we all thought he is. He is a partner in crime, and he has Palestinian blood on his hands.
You know, just to put a little context, and you mentioned Libya, and just so people understand how bipartisan this policy is, it was, Democrats who played a major role in destabilizing Libya, Gaddafi, making it nice and soft, I guess, if when they get ready to work with the Israelis to ship out the Palestinians. Do you really think, given the ferocity of the resistance, despite, the United States and Israel being the two most powerful armies in the world, that the resistance continues? I mean, how do you see where this is now? Because the whole world doesn't see the power of the resistance, but it is still there, isn't it?
It is. And Dennis, I think we've spoken about this before. The power and resistance is not just with armed resistance and, bombs and guns. It is also with resisting to accept apartheid and genocide and accept U.S. interventionism and Israeli supremacy in the region. Whether that resistance is by, writing a poem or boycotting a company that contributes to apartheid and genocide, it is very, very widespread. It is worldwide, and I don't think it's easy to quash it. Even if the U.S. and Israel have the biggest bombs, that will not hide the truth.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We speak with Riad Jarrar. And also in the studio with me is Miguel Gavilan Molina. My senior producer here has a question for you, Riad. Welcome.
Thank you, Dennis. I have a question, you know. We here, our listeners, people involved in the social justice movement within the United States right now, because we have a tyrannical dictator that's taken over the White House. And what do you see that, you know, people, our listeners, people here within the United States, what can we do, being that it looks like the United Nations is powerless, the Western world really is distracted, they don't care? What can people do in this country that do care, our listeners that do care, what can we do to, you know, stop this and bring it to a halt? Otherwise, it's just going to continue and expand. We know what the Trump administration, you know, their trip to the Middle East, real estate deals, you know, getting gifts, being bribed, et cetera, with all of that chaos and confusion, what can people do to stand up against this genocide?
It's honestly an all-the-above approach. There isn't a silver bullet for ending the genocide, for ending apartheid, for ending decades of injustice that was brought upon the region and the world by the U.S. Empire. This is an all-the-above approach. And we can look at examples through history here in our country, in the United States, you know, like the fight, like racial justice fights that we had in the United States did not happen overnight. They happened over years and decades. And at one point, I think there was feelings of despair, and there were feelings that we're unable to prevail and end this very big injustice. And we never ended it completely. I mean, look at the genocide that we had in this country against Native Americans, or slavery in this country that we never actually fully resolved, or paid reparations to slaves and descendants of slaves who are still living the consequences of slavery and the, you know, Jim Crow era policies. But if you look at these things, they're incremental and they take a long time. Look internationally at what happened with South Africa, with apartheid South Africa. It also took years and decades of fighting against what seemed at the time to be a brutal, endless, you know, tyranny by white South Africans who were supported by, you know, by Israel and the United States, by the way.
Yes.
But the fact of the matter is this: whatever is going on in Israel now is not sustainable. This is not going to continue forever. Their genocide is not going to continue forever. Their apartheid is not going to continue forever. And whatever we're doing now, whether it is organizing in our communities, whether it is you know, starting with ourselves to educate ourselves and listen to the right news stations and subscribe to the right you know, activist organizations who are bringing some news from the ground and advocating for a change. Whether we give a donation to our local station, whether we give $10 to this nonprofit or that nonprofit, all of these small steps are a part of the bigger incremental change that will happen. So I don't want your listeners to feel that because we've been trying to stop the genocide for 19 months and it's still going on, that we should just, you know, throw our arms in the air and just like go home. Because we need to do more and more and more of the same, and we have to continue to do an all-of-the-above approach until we see the change that we want to see.
Thank you, Rayard. We've been speaking with Rayard Jarar. He works with he's the advocacy director for Democracy for the Arab World Now. They're a social rights group. You all have been engaging at a lot of different levels, trying to restrain what we are all watching with horror. Thank you for taking the time repeatedly to be with us and to help inform our audience as to have a better understanding about what's going on the ground. Thanks, Rayard.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're absolutely welcome, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are going to take a necessary and amazing musical break with our resident musician, troubadour Francisco Herrera. When we come back, we're going to take it to L.A. because it's time to go back to Baca's backyard. Stay tuned.
Pueblo, pueblo, canta tu canción, pueblo, pueblo, pueblo tú, pueblo yo, canta tu canción. The first word of oppression is shut up. Don't tell mommy, don't tell the union, don't tell anything, don't say anything. You aren't, you aren't, you aren't. Shut up. The first word of liberation is speak out, speak loud, be strong, tell your story, sing your song. You are, you are, you are. Yeah, oh, 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 pueblo, pueblo, pueblo tú, pueblo yo, canta tu canción. Sigues cruzando las fronteras y los valles, los desiertos, los ríos, cerros y canales. Solo tú sabes lo que has tenido que sufrir, y así persistes construyendo un porvenir. Yeah. Oh, 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 pueblo, pueblo, desde Argentina hasta Canadá, canta tu canción. No hay muro que detenga tus ganas de amar. Oh, te veo vendiendo naranjas y sandías debajo de los freeways día a día, sembrando flores, cosechando amores, haciendo vida por donde quiera que va. Oh, 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 pueblo, pueblo, no hay muro que detenga tus ganas de amar. Canta tu canción, ni violencia que pueda quitarte la libertad. Oh, 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 pueblo, pueblo, como el agua, como el viento, regresas a tu hogar. Pachamama, Gran Anáhuac, Turtle Island, Aslan. Canta tu canción.
Francisco Herrera, our resident troubadour, beloved in this hemisphere, traveled through the war-torn hills of El Salvador trying to counteract the slaughter and the slaughters that the United States government continues to fund. Remember, every shredded three-month-old, Kamalan and Francisco, everyone blown to bits is being being blown to bits by tax dollars, by our, the United States, and it is our. Don't say it's not yours, because it's ours.
65 cents out of every dollar.
Is going to the killing fields in this world, and that is what has to change. And we're blessed to have these microphones, free speech, truth to power mics, to continue. Joining us now is what we are have started doing. We call Baca's Backyard, Gary Baca from our acting program director from our sister station, KPFK. Also a wonderful reporter, observer of events, joins us every weekday to every Friday to tell us about what's happening on the ground in LA, and these are important times for Los Angeles. Gary, welcome back.
Thank you, Dennis. Good to be back.
Pleasure to have you. I'm here with Francisco and Gavilan.
Oh, well, you know, Francisco,
what's happening?
Another great song. I mean, Francisco, he's so inspiring. For a minute, I thought that was you, Dennis. I was,
we'll be like, there June 21st.
I can't sing it. Okay. So and then it dawned on me, that's Francisco.
Yeah,
that's it.
Oh, that's the funniest thing.
One day I will sound like Dennis. Yeah. But you gotta come to June 21st, brother, at the Herbst Theater. Migration Strengthens the Nation is the concert we're putting on.
Oh, wow. I gotta be there. I'll be there.
Orale.
So, no, another beautiful day in L.A., Dennis. A lot going on. 73 degrees out here. I was thinking of going to the beach after, but I'm not sure. But things that are happening in L.A. After a year, the L.A. City Council passed a proposal for a minimum wage hike for L.A. workers in the tourism industry for hotel and airport workers, Local 11. The goal is to reach $30 an hour by 2028, by the time the Olympics hit L.A. So 12 of the 15 council members voted yes. The proposal is to raise wages for hotel and airport workers to $22.50 an hour starting in July, then increases of $2.50 an hour each year thereafter for 3 years.
That's great.
And then raised to $25 an hour in 2026, then $27.50 an hour in 2027, then by 2028, it'll be $30 an hour. So it's a big victory for workers in tourism. Most of the LA workers are people of color, black and brown people. This would affect hotels with 60 or more rooms, especially near LAX. And Dennis, I know you're going to ask me, I feel it, that are there any opponents to this? Of course. Hotel industry leaders tried to shut it down, saying it would be bad for business and drive up hotel and flying rates. But now workers are saying we can work one job instead of two or three jobs, spend more time with family. As a matter of fact, Jovan Houston is with Airport Workers United, and she says she would be able to pay her bills on time, better housing for her and her son. And so there's a lot going on.
And you know, Gary, I went with some of those airport workers, you know, cleaning those airplanes inside and doing all the stuff they do to prepare them. It gets up to 120 degrees inside those planes, people dehydrating, fainting, getting sick. It's quite a hell in those airplanes.
And we're hoping that maybe this will set a precedent for other countries and communities to know that, you know, workers do need a raise, and it's about time. Here's an update about the reconstruction of the Altadena community. They're fighting against investors. So activists gathered to keep the redevelopment with families who have lived in the Altadena area for decades and not be put in the hands of corporate developers. The firestorm earlier this year destroyed 9,000 structures and killed 18 people. So community members say predatory and greedy corporations have launched a land grab in the Altadena area, taking advantage of this tragedy. The developers are trying to get land for pennies on the dollar. They are calling on Newsom and Sacramento to dedicate $200 million for local disaster recovery. They want nonprofit organizations to purchase fire damaged housing and commercial properties, which can be sold at affordable prices for community ownership. After the Eaton fire, half the land purchases were corporate entities. So Senator Perez, representing Eaton, says her number one priority is to get relief funds for that community. And also, animal rights groups and activists are upset with the L.A. Zoo as they attempt to transfer two aging elephants to a Tulsa, Oklahoma zoo instead of a safe sanctuary. So right now, a judge is going to determine the fate of these two aging elephants, Billy and Tina. Advocates want them to retire. You know, they have been in the zoo for over two decades, and they don't want them to go to another zoo. So protests are happening now in front of the zoo with signs like "Not Another Zoo," hashtag Free Billy, hashtag Free Tina, No Tulsa, Free Tina, and in defense of animals, named LA Zoo number one worst zoo for elephants in 2023. And even singer actress Cher chimed in, supporting the two elephants, saying Billy and Tina deserve freedom. So that's just a few things that are happening here in Los Angeles.
Gary, we just have a minute left, but I did want to follow up. We are trying to monitor the implications of the sort of fear mongering, and there's always a new trick every morning that Trump has to make poor and working class people miserable. And everybody knows the suffering is immense. I'm wondering if people are still taking precautions. Are they settling into the age of Trump? What's the vibe in LA? Do we feel this kind of crackdown and this limitation on civil liberties expanding? How's that feel?
Well, I think people are feeling violated, and I think they're still in fear. You know, with the prices going up, with the tariffs, I think people and family are affected. You know, so I think that people are preparing themselves for what's happening in the future. ICE has been roaming around Los Angeles. They've been called out by various organizations, so we are aware of what's going on. But for the most part, I think people are preparing themselves for the next 3 years, in the sense of saying, you know, we need to be involved, we need to organize, we need to get in contact with city council members, we need to work with the mayor. We are still a sanctuary city, so folks, you know, are feeling somewhat safe, but anything can happen at the drop of a dime. So I think overall people are aware of what's going on, and I think that the people are ready for anything that comes at them. As you know, the budget cuts with Trump has affected everyone out here, but people are coming together. They're coming together in a way that are helping each other. I've been seeing stories here and there that people are lending hands, you know, giving out food, also clothing. And so I think people are coming together and being more united, but they're also aware.
Thank you, Gary Bach. Bach's Backyard every Friday on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Gary, thanks for keeping us posted on what's happening in L.A. and parts south. We care a great deal about our brothers and sisters down there. So please keep us posted, and we'll talk to you next week for sure.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dennis. And let's stay together, south, north, Central California. We're all together.
Yes, we're all together. And for sure, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Some of you are going to hear a rebroadcast of the Intifada newscast, and some will hear us continuing to talk here at the Mothership, KPFA. We appreciate it all. Stay tuned.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 587 of the genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel has accelerated its attacks on Palestinians, massacring dozens of people each day in tent shelters, in schools turned into housing for displaced families, in residential buildings, and inside two hospitals. U.S. President Donald Trump's Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff said he is hopeful that a ceasefire deal can be reached after yet more talks in Doha with Qatari officials, but of course no further details have been revealed. However, Israeli Prime Minister and war crimes fugitive Benjamin Netanyahu declared that even if captured, Israeli soldiers are released under the terms of a ceasefire, he is still intent on escalating attacks and, quote, destroying Hamas. He said, quote, "We'll take them," meaning the Israeli captives, "and then we'll go in. There will be no way we will stop the war." Netanyahu boasted to lawmakers in the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee that the Israeli army is, quote, "destroying more and more houses in Gaza," and that Palestinians have nowhere to return. "The only obvious result will be Gazans choosing to emigrate outside of the Strip," Netanyahu continued, "but our main problem is finding countries to take them in." Since Israel broke the ceasefire on March 18th, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says that more than 2,800 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 8,000 have been injured. The ministry states that as of May 14th, approximately 53,000 Palestinians have been killed since October 7th, 2023, with thousands more missing and buried under the rubble. At least 100 people have been killed in airstrikes on homes and tent shelters since dawn in Jabalia, Khan Yunis, Maghazi refugee camp, and Al-Mawasi. On Wednesday, May 14th, the Israeli army spokesperson issued forced displacement orders for Palestinians in Gaza City, including yet another order to empty Al-Shifa Hospital. The spokesperson said the military planned to attack, quote, "with great force." The Israeli military had already killed more than 80 Palestinians since dawn on Wednesday, including approximately 50 killed in Jabalia in northern Gaza. Al Jazeera's reporter Tarek Abu Azoum stated that airstrikes targeted five residential buildings packed with civilians in Jabalia and the Jabalia refugee camp. Quote, "Civil defense teams reported that the scene of the attack was horrific. First-hand accounts say the Israeli army launched consecutive strikes without any prior warning and that many of the victims remain under the rubble. We continue to get testimonies saying the morgue of the Indonesian hospital has been flooded with bodies," Abu Azoum stated. Mohamed Awad, an emergency doctor in the Indonesian hospital, told Agence France-Presse that supply shortages meant his department could not properly handle the flow of wounded and that the, quote, "bodies of the martyrs are lying on the ground in the hospital corridors. There are not enough beds, no medicine, and no means for surgical or medical treatment, which leaves doctors unable to save many of the injured who are dying due to lack of care," he said. Jabalia has been under heavy bombardment all week. On Friday, May 9th, a United Nations aid distribution center that had also been sheltering displaced families was attacked, killing at least four Palestinians. On May 11th, Israel bombed the Fatima Bani Assad school that has been sheltering displaced families, killing at least 15 people. Journalist Mahmoud Abu Salama reported from the scene. He said that the Israeli military bombed the school, turning the site into widespread destruction. Quote, "displaced people were sleeping, holding on to the hope of a ceasefire agreement, but Israeli airstrikes targeted them here without warning." Israeli gunboats fired on Gaza fishers on May 10th. Injuring Palestinians trying to find any source of food for their families in the sea. On Tuesday, May 13th, Israel bombed two hospitals in Khan Yunis in the south, the European Gaza Hospital and the Nasser Medical Complex. Israel used bunker buster bombs and fire belts on the European Gaza Hospital, killing at least 28 Palestinians and wounding dozens in multiple strikes. Israeli media claimed without evidence that there were tunnels under the hospital and that Mohammed Sinwar, the military commander of the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, was the target of the attack. CCTV footage obtained by Al Jazeera showed the moment Israel bombed the courtyard of the hospital. Journalist Moaz Toha spoke to hospital staff and medical workers who showed massive pieces of shrapnel that tore through the facility. Both hospital staff and medical workers described shrapnel and the bombing ripping through emergency areas and damaging parts of the building. At least 6 people were martyred and more than 40 others injured. Attacks on the European Gaza hospital continued on Wednesday, May 14th. 6 consecutive airstrikes hit areas around the hospital compound, targeting a bulldozer that was working to clear rubble and recover bodies underneath from Tuesday's attacks. A doctor at the European Gaza Hospital, Adnan Issa, recorded this voice message for logistics coordinator Afif Nesouli, who works with the medical group GLIA in Gaza. Adnan Issa says that there was continuous bombing.
I'm stuck in the hospital right now, and really the situation is very bad, bad, bad. It's so bad. And really pray for me. And oh my God, a lot of bombing around my hospital and in my hospital. And that's very terrible thing.
As of today, Thursday, the European Gaza Hospital has been forced to close completely. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says that Israel's attacks caused significant damage to infrastructure, including sewage lines, damage to internal departments, and destruction of roads leading to the hospital. Nasser Medical Complex, also in Khan Yunis, was bombed in the pre-dawn hours on Tuesday, May 13th, killing 2 Palestinians. 18 hospital beds in the surgical department, 8 beds in the intensive care unit, and 10 inpatient beds were also destroyed, according to medical sources. The attack was a targeted assassination of journalist Hassan Asleya, who was a contributor to local and international news outlets and was a prominent reporter in Gaza. Dropsite News says that Asleya's footage of airstrikes, raids, and the aftermath of civilian massacres was used by AP, CNN, Getty, Sky News, and the New York Times. In early April, Asleya was the intended target of a drone strike on a media tent outside the hospital. The strike killed reporter Ahmed Mansour, who was captured on video sitting in a chair with his head and chest on fire. Mansour died a few days later while receiving treatment in the intensive care unit. The Israeli army had accused Asleya of being affiliated with Hamas's armed wing and claimed that he had participated in the October 7th operation. Asleya, who was severely injured in the attack on the media tent, told Mondo Weiss 2 days after the attacks on April 9th that, quote, "the occupation is trying to obliterate the image of Palestinian journalists with these false claims that they belong to Hamas and other factions." Anyone with even a passing knowledge of Hamas and how the Qassam brigades operate will instantly recognize how utterly incoherent the Israeli army's claims are, noted Mondo Weiss contributor Tarek Hajjaj, who profiled Hassan Asleya. But Israel is counting on people's ignorance and gullibility to believe that a dedicated journalist who operates in the field 24/7 also moonlights as a Hamas fighter. Asleya knew there was a target on his back. He told Mondo Weiss that, quote, "it would not be difficult for the occupation to assassinate me again, especially with the increasing incitement I hear and see against me. They may target me inside the hospital, in this room of mine. What can I do? I am not fighting. I am working, and I bear responsibility for my profession," Hassan Asleya continued. "If the Israeli army kills me, the photos I took and the stories I told the world will live on. My name, my cause, and my voice will live on, and the occupation will die." Journalist Ahmed Al-Najjar reported from Nasser Hospital on Wednesday.
The burns department inside Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, but as you can see, it is completely destroyed because the Israeli occupation's warplanes bombed it over the night, killing and assassinating one prominent Palestinian journalist here. Our colleague Hassan Asleya, one of the press prominent figures and pillars in the Gaza Strip, was assassinated here after almost over a month of another attempt of assassinating him right outside that hospital. It wasn't just Hassan who was receiving treatment here, it was him and dozens of the wounded people who sustained burns by the Israeli occupation's attack. And as you can see, everything here is destroyed. The beds, the medical equipment, Everything here is destroyed following this lethal attack by the Israeli occupation, who continues to suppress and assassinate all those trying to show the truth and broadcast what is happening here to the world.
That was Ahmed Al-Najjar. The Gaza government media office says that Hassan Asleya, assassinated in his hospital bed at Nasser Medical Complex, was the 215th journalist and media worker in Gaza killed since October 2023. Condolences and condemnations over Asleya's assassination poured in from all across Gaza and around the world. There was a massive funeral procession in the streets in Khan Yunis for Hassan Asleya on Tuesday amidst the rubble. Also on Tuesday, Israeli forces shot and killed a 12-year-old boy, Mohammed al-Bardawil, in al-Mawasi. The child, along with his father, Saeed, was an eyewitness to the massacre of paramedics and first responders in Rafah on March 23rd. As you'll remember, the Israeli army had ambushed a convoy of ambulances, executed the paramedics, and threw their bodies into a mass pit. They also buried the ambulances in the sand. The boy and his father were on their way to go fishing when they were detained by Israeli soldiers before the attack on March 23rd and were subsequently abducted. They were interviewed by the New York Times for its investigation into the massacre. A second round of testimonies was scheduled for Mohammed al-Bardawil to assist in an international commission on war crimes, with testimonies and evidence submitted to the UN office and the South African legal team at the International Court of Justice. But he was killed before he was able to provide further eyewitness testimony. More than 70 days have passed since Israel closed all the crossings into Gaza, creating mass starvation and an engineered medical catastrophe for Gaza's 2 million Palestinians. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza stated on May 11th that there is now a dangerous acceleration of a severe shortage of pharmaceutical supplies and that 43% of essential medicines are at zero stock. 64% of medical supplies are at zero stock, and emergency, operating room, and intensive care units are operating on depleted stocks, with critical cases on the rise. Since the aid blockade began on March 2nd, 57 children have reportedly died from the effects of malnutrition, according to the Ministry of Health. This number is likely an underestimate and is expected to increase. A new alert published on May 12th by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the global standard for assessing food insecurity, says that starvation has reached unprecedented levels. The entire population of Gaza is now classified in emergency, with more than 71,000 children aged 6 months to 5 years old suffering from acute malnutrition, including more than 14,000 severe cases. The situation is growing equally dire for pregnant and breastfeeding women, with an estimated 18,000 women expected to require urgent treatment to avoid life-threatening and irreversible health consequences for both mothers and infants. Euromed Human Rights Monitor says a silent death is sweeping through Gaza's community of elders as well. Now entering its third consecutive month, the intensified siege has had devastating and long-term effects, disproportionately harming Gaza's most vulnerable, Euromed says. Israel's systematic policy seeks to destroy all means of survival and eliminate any path to staying alive. This deepens the humanitarian catastrophe, making it a central instrument in the execution of genocidal policy. Over the past week, 14 elderly Palestinians were documented to have died across Gaza from complications related to hunger, malnutrition, and lack of medical care. These deaths are directly linked to Israel's complete closure of border crossings and its prevention of humanitarian aid and essential goods from entering the Strip since March 2nd. The rights group stated. A proposed Israeli-American mechanism for humanitarian aid in Gaza, Euromed added, is nothing more than a new maneuver aimed at prolonging the illegal and comprehensive blockade. It repackages the crime of starvation in a misleading humanitarian guise, falsely legitimizing its continued use as a weapon in the ongoing crime of genocide. The aid agency Oxfam said this week that, quote, Gaza's starvation is not incidental. It is deliberate, entirely engineered, and has now created the largest population facing starvation anywhere in the world, a preventable famine unfolding in real time. It is unconscionable and is being allowed to happen. Furthermore, Oxfam stated, quote, Israel's plan to militarize the delivery of humanitarian aid, an egregious violation of international humanitarian law, threatens to push this already catastrophic crisis into full collapse. Turning aid into a tool of control endangers civilians, erodes the neutrality of humanitarian work, and risks unleashing even greater chaos and suffering across Gaza. Early this morning, May 15th, Israeli forces killed two more journalists in airstrikes on Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The Gaza government media office stated that Ahmed Anwar Abdelhadi Al-Helou, who worked as an editor for the Quds News Network, and Hassan Marzouk Samour, who worked as a broadcaster and presenter for Sawat Al-Aqsa Radio, were killed along with their families in separate bombings. After Hassan Asleh's assassination, the Gaza government media office says that 217 journalists and media workers have been killed since October 2023. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of A Long-Awaited Reunion in Amman by Khaled El-Hissi, writing from exile in Jordan. Khaled is one of our longtime contributors and is from Jabalia in northern Gaza. He has been receiving treatment for blood cancer in Amman, Jordan, for some time now and has written extensively about his friends and family in Gaza who have been killed or displaced. He wrote this week about meeting up with his good friend Abu Bakr Abed, who passed through Amman on his way to Ireland a few weeks ago. Khaled describes encountering Abu Bakr for the first time, both as university students at the Islamic University of Gaza in 2021, and how their friendship evolved and tightened over time, especially after the genocide began in 2023. Khaled writes that, quote, on April 17th, 2025, my sleep was fitful as my thoughts kept returning to my cousin Wasim El-Hissi, 10, who had been killed the day before when Israel bombed my cousin's family's home in Jabalia. Mohanned, 5, Khaula, 3, and Wasim were the children of my cousin Hamouda, a pet name for Muhammad. Mayar, just 2 months old, was the only daughter of my cousin Haytham. Israel killed them in an instant. My cousins later collected the remains of one of the children's intestines from a tree. After countless attempts at falling asleep, tossing in bed, staring at the ceiling, checking the time on my phone, moving to the couch, then back to bed again, I still couldn't quiet the jumble of thoughts crowding my mind. I was already exhausted. 2 days earlier, I had taken a dose of chemotherapy medication, and the side effects were brutal. I drifted off eventually, only to be woken at exactly 8:45 a.m. by two calls from a Jordanian number I didn't recognize. Half asleep, I squinted at the screen and muttered to myself, "Who's calling at this hour?" I didn't answer. I went back to sleep. I woke up around noon and decided to grab a falafel sandwich with some fava beans for breakfast from a nearby shop. At 1:20 p.m., while I was on my way, Abu Bakr messaged me, "Call me now, immediately." I thought something might have happened to him, or that he wanted to show me the field where he was working as a correspondent at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, as he often did. I tried calling, but the line didn't go through. A moment later, he called me instead. "How are you?" he asked. "I'm fine, but it's you who I should ask, how are you?" I replied. "I want to tell you something, but promise me you'll keep it a secret. Promise me," Abu Bakr said. "I promise," I replied. "I'm in Amman." "You're joking, Ya Rajal," I said, using the Arabic word for man, thinking he was messing with me. "Wallahi, I'm not joking," he said, swearing by God. "I'm really in Amman." Khaled writes that they immediately met up and had a tearful reunion. Abu Bakr tells him about the journey he took after leaving Gaza, the bus driving through historic Palestine, seeing it for the first time in his life. Abu Bakr, finishing his washing before prayers, tells Khaled, quote, "I'd give everything up just to take that journey again, to see Palestine again. Our country is the most beautiful in the world, and that's exactly why they've stolen it." I'm telling you, Khaled, once I finish my treatment here, I'm going back to Gaza. We all need to go back. Our country needs us. I cut in, me too. As soon as I finish my treatment, I'm going back, just like you. Gaza needs us, and not just Gaza, Khaled, he smiled, gently correcting me. All of Palestine needs us. He looked at me, his voice steady. We, the youth, are the ones who will liberate this land. No one else will do it for us. It's on us to free Palestine. Those are excerpts from A Long-Awaited Reunion in Amman by Khaled El-Hissi on electronicintifada.net. Turning quickly to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces on Wednesday demolished more homes in the Nur Shams refugee camp in the northern city of Tul Karem as the military aggression on the camp entered the 95th day, according to local news. Wafa news agency said that Israeli bulldozers tore down residential buildings in the vicinity of the Abu Bakr as-Siddiq Mosque at a time when infantry soldiers deployed on a large scale and opened live ammunition at Palestinian civilians and even at media personnel. The Israeli soldiers obstructed residents from entering the refugee camp to retrieve their belongings before the demolition of their houses. Local estimates indicate that Israeli army bulldozers tore down 20 structures in the previous week, and the occupation troops blew up other residential structures whose owners were displaced. 2 weeks ago, on May 1st, Israeli occupying forces issued military orders to demolish 106 Palestinian-owned structures in Tul Karem and Nur Shams refugee camps, giving residents 24 hours to evacuate. In Jenin, also in the northern West Bank, Israeli forces have expanded its incursion into the Jenin refugee camp, going on 115 days. The Jenin municipality said that Israeli forces have completely demolished approximately 600 homes inside the camp, while the rest have been partially damaged and rendered uninhabitable. The occupation continues to fire live ammunition intensively in the camp, Wafa News Agency reported. 2 weeks ago, as we reported, the Jenin-based veteran journalist Ali Samoudi was arrested after Israeli soldiers raided his home, beat him, and took him to a military barracks. The 58-year-old reporter has now been sentenced by an Israeli military court to 6 months administrative detention, which is an arbitrary imprisonment without charge or trial, and he is currently in Megiddo prison. Administrative detention orders can, of course, be renewed indefinitely. Samoudi was working alongside Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh when she was assassinated by an Israeli sniper in May 2022. He was also shot in the shoulder during that attack. CNN, which has worked with Samoudi over the years, stated that the Israeli military acknowledged that it does not have sufficient evidence to substantiate terrorism funding allegations it leveled against Samoudi, but the military court sentenced him anyway. The military's administrative detention order cites Samoudi's, quote, presence posing a danger to the security of the region as justification for his detention. He's one of 20 journalists detained and held under administrative detention since the start of the war on Gaza, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine. Our longtime contributor, Mohammed Assad, an incredible photojournalist, recently posted images to his Instagram account. He says that after 2 months of Israel's forced starvation policy, he had no choice but to dive into the sea, trying to catch any fish to get a little protein for his children. He writes that even though he was forced to swim amongst raw sewage and evade Israeli naval ships that opened fire at fishers on the shore, as well as a quadcopter drone that bombed a fisher next to him, he returned with an octopus for his family. Mohammed says, quote, I don't know if I should feel joy for bringing back this food or simply for surviving. Mahmoud Zouaiter, a prominent actor and comedian in Gaza, posted this last week. I'll narrate what he says after we play this short clip.
Hello,
That was Mahmoud Zouaiter. While walking and holding three blooming roses, he says, quote, "These were planted in Gaza, folks. Can you imagine? The owner of a shop stopped me and gave them to me. I told him that I was embarrassed to walk down the street with them, but he insisted that I take them because my birthday is coming up. They grew in Gaza. Do you see? God is good and generous. This rose is for you, from the inside of Gaza to you." And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Ooh, Daddy, las mamas están aquí para darles información, música y diversión con el show de Mujeres Bravas, los domingos desde las 12 hasta la 1:30 de la tarde. El que se quede en su